probably shouldn't be yawning at the beginning of my answer. Okay. That's all right. Forget you saw that. Yeah.
So I guess it's time to start the afternoon session. So welcome. But before we start, there's a suggestion that since there's a few of us, perhaps we could all stand up and introduce each other. So, let's do that now. My name is Rabbi Levon, and we'll be chairing the session.
I'm that guy.
I'm the doctor. I'm postdoctor.
And you're a also a postdoctor.
I'm Shantanu Desai, postdoctor.
I'm Tina Nautor, and I'm a
now that everyone knows what about this, it is a pleasure to have Mark Rodham this afternoon, and he will tell us about some issues regarding cosmic acceleration.
Thanks. I didn't really know what to put together for this workshop, so it's sort of a little bit of a mix of several things I wanted to say. There should be some overlap, I think, with what Lucia had to say, and also quite a bit of overlap with what Roy will say after me. So hopefully there'll be. There's at least one joke that I used here a year ago, so those of you who were in my talk a year ago, please just laugh politely. All right, so let me just get some acknowledgements out of the way. There's a lot of work sort of here and there throughout this talk that I'll talk about, and all these people were involved with it. I won't go through the color coding or anything, but their various stages of their careers, and I'll acknowledge my funding as well. Okay, so I'm going to put one slide up on the inventory of the stuff that is in the universe. I think Lucia probably did a much longer and more detailed version of that this morning, and I won't hop on it. But what I really want to do is talk about the structure of the dark sector. I won't talk in detail about dark matter. Katie's going to do that, hopefully. At least she told me she was going to do it. And then what I want to talk about mostly is cosmic acceleration. I want to talk about the dark energy, and in particular a little bit about modified gravity and the challenges it poses. Roy's going to talk about that a lot later. And that will lead me to discuss the question of the possibility of couplings in the dark sector, whether it's interesting to consider couplings between dark energy and dark matter and how one might constrain such couplings theoretically and observationally. But since I won't have too much time there, what I'll actually do is focus on a particular class of models, coupled models, and I'll identify a particular regime in those models, namely what I call the adiabatic regime, and I'll sort of illustrate a sort of generic instability that occurs in this regime in these models and use that to bound large class of coupled models. And there'll be a lot of open questions, I expect, at the end of this, so hopefully tomorrow in this discussion session there might be quite a lot to talk about. Okay, so one slide on the new cosmology. We have so much data, it's an embarrassment. We have lensing and galaxy rotation curves and supernovae and the microwave background and now polarization of the microwave background, precision measurements of the power spectrum, and abundances of the light elements, and I could go on and on and on. And what this has allowed us to do is that if you think in the context of general relativity coupled to traditional matter sources, is to identify the stuff of the universe in this pie chart that everyone is obliged to show by the funding agencies. 4% of the universe is in atoms, stuff that you're made of. 22% or so dark matter. And at least in this accounting, 74% of the universe is due to a new kind of stuff called dark energy, which could be a cosmological constant, could be an evolving dynamical component, or could in fact be a misrepresentation of how we came to this in the first place, namely a modification of gravity. So let me sort of write down the usual way we think about dark energy. So here are the sort of background equations of cosmology as they appear to simple-minded theoretical cosmologists. There's the Friedmann equation, tells you how the scale factor of the universe, A of t, evolves in time as governed by the matter content of the universe. This is all the possible dark matter, baryons, dark energy, whatever you might have. And then there's also the acceleration equation, which tells you how that's changing in time. And that's coupled to the sum of the energy densities and three times the pressure of all the different components. And if you parameterize the different types of matter in the universe by this sort of canonical way of writing it, namely that the ith type of matter has a pressure related to its energy density by an equation of state parameter. So in the case of dark matter, this just gets called W, sort of dark energy, this gets called W usually, and this is what Chia was referring to this morning. Then when the evolution is dominated by, say, type I, you can just write down simple solutions to these equations if you ignore spatial curvature, which I certainly will in the late universe. Now, because of that, it's very easy to identify what we mean by cosmic acceleration. Namely, if the universe is accelerating, then A dot over A must be positive, and therefore whatever is the dominant component of the cosmic energy budget today must have an equation of state parameter which is less than minus a third. So by dark energy, we mean some component that obeys this. And at this level, there are three broad possibilities. It's possible that W lies between minus a third and minus one. This would be the sort of quintessence possibility. This is a type of stuff in the universe that dilutes more slowly than any matter. So the universe expands. It gets bigger. As the volume increases, the energy density of this dark energy, this quintessence, will decrease, but it will do so at a rate more slowly than the regular matter in the universe, such that at late times it dominates. And if you let things go on long enough, then the scale factor of the universe, this A of T, will approach a solution where it evolves like a power law, typically. And this is what you might call power law quintessence. W could be minus one, and if it's minus one exactly, and everything that I've assumed so far holds, namely general relativity, coupled to these normal matter sources, then this is a cosmological constant. It is absolutely constant. It doesn't vary in space or time. And at the end of the day, in the far future, when other things are diluted, you will approach exponential expansion. At the level that I've described it, there's also a third possibility, W less than minus 1. If this is true, then as the universe expands, its volume increases, and the energy density in this weird stuff increases, which you should strongly dislike. And in fact, if this is really true and W is constant, will increase, the scale factor will reach an infinite value in a finite time. This is what gets usually termed the big rip. It doesn't have to be this way. This can be a transient phase in the universe. There's all kinds of ways to get around this conclusion. But this should really bother you, and I'll come back and have a little bit more to say about that later on. So what are the logical possibilities for acceleration? Well, if you look at the Einstein equation, then one possibility, as I've just been outlining, is that there are these new mass energy sources in the Einstein equation. Quintessence, k-essence, oscillating dark energy. And many people have worked on this. Every cosmologist you can think of has their own model of this. Okay. I've missed many names up here. This is a typing until I got tired of typing names on this slide. Then there are modifications of gravity. Inverse curvature gravity, DGP brain wheels, which I think Roy will mention, Cardassian models that Katie has worked on. There are other examples also. And again, a whole host of people have been thinking about these. And then there's a possibility which is other, and by other I don't mean is logically distinct from these two categories, just I don't really quite know how to categorize these things. Cosmological constant itself sort of echoes back to our discussion this morning. Extra dimensions, depending on quite how you view the effect. Back reaction, the anthropic principle. There are many other people who have worked on these. I tried hard not to say anything about the anthropic principle. And again, so these are sort of the three different classes of attempts that people have made to address this problem from a sort of theoretical viewpoint. Now, the big question, as Abhay said this morning, and I agree with him, is not so much, why is the cosmological constant so small, but is this a cosmological constant? And the point is that if it's not a cosmological constant that's causing cosmic acceleration, you should be delighted. Because a cosmological constant is the worst possible answer from the point of view of trying to figure out what it is. Okay, so from the point of view of Arnold Schwarzenegger, the cosmological constant is a bad answer, and you want something like the Predator. Okay, if it bleeds, we can kill it. Okay, you need it to do something. Cluster, change in time, do something, contribute to structure formation, do something else other than just be there forever in the same amount no matter what. Okay, so Arnold may not be a good governor, but he's a very good physicist. So if it's not a cosmological constant, then you have a much better hope of getting a hold on what it is. So what does the data tell us? Well, we could go on and on about this, and Lucia certainly showed many more current data than I'm going to show here, but I just want to draw one sort of important point from this, which is that the data tells us that W is around minus 1, and it could be less than minus 1, and it could be greater than minus 1, and that's what we know right now. We really don't know a lot more than this. We can ask questions, how well do we know that it is or is not changing with time? How well do we know that it was minus 1 at a redshift of 2, at a redshift of 3? And that's just, we don't. But we just know this, actually, pretty much. It's not quite right what I said, but it's close enough. But the reason I show this is that I had talked about the three possibilities for W on a previous slide, and I do, in a moment, want to talk about what exactly is being measured when we say W is greater than minus 1, is less than minus 1, or is minus 1. So I just wanted to highlight it on this slide. So let me dispose with quintessence in one slide. So quintessence is the idea that we have some form of matter, and since we're cosmologists, we are mandated to use a scalar field for this, that forces the universe to accelerate at late times. This is essentially inflation at low energies, at late times, without the requirement that it must end. And so you write down a potential. You write down a potential that will eventually give you slow roll, by which I mean if you look at the energy density and pressure in the field phi, and you take the ratio of the pressure to the energy density, then slow roll means that these become small, and you are therefore close to minus 1, and you're accelerating. And if you do that with the right kinds of potentials, then you can indeed get late-time cosmic acceleration from a model like this. You haven't solved the cosmological constant problem. It's still there, but maybe we don't care. Maybe it's just a small number. The point about this is not that you should think of it as a worse way of getting a cosmological constant. The point about this is that it is another way to get acceleration, and one which, in principle, is testably distinguishable from a cosmological constant in the details, not just in the expansion history. So this is the idea of quintessence. But there is another possibility here, which is if you have, let me just step back a moment, if you have quintessence, for example, or a cosmological constant, or whatever you like, and you're inferring from it this value of W, how can you be sure that what you're getting is something that's related to the microphysical structure of the theory? So let me give you a sort of example of that. If I take the Friedmann equation and the acceleration equation and I invert them for what I call the equation of state, then I get this equation. Okay? So this is a thing you actually infer from the Hubble plot. You actually average this, but the point I want to make is not dependent on the averaging. So this is the thing you infer from the Hubble plot. So if you truly have Einstein gravity coupled to energy momentum sources, then this is a microphysical, a quantity that describes the microphysical properties of the dark energy. And if that's less than minus 1, you should really worry. That weird behavior I told you on the previous slide will be true. And in particular, if you try to write down a sensible quantum field theoretic description of this, you'll be sadly disappointed because it will be a ghost and it'll be deeply unstable, as I'll mention later. But of course, if you don't have Einstein gravity and you still write down this, this is just a function. It's just a function of H dot, and omega matter. And that's all. It's nothing to do with the microphysics of whatever's driving the dark energy. So in particular, to be specific, and this is not supposed to be a way of selling you how the world works, take a Brans-Dickey theory. So here's Brans-Dickey theory with a potential, okay, with the matter Lagrangian. For omega here, greater than 40,000, as limited by signal timing measurements from the Cassini mission, this is entirely consistent with all known tests of gravity. And yet, you can write down, if you write down a dark energy component here, and I ask what's happening with cosmology, for somewhat contrived choices of the potential V, you can infer W less than minus 1 today, even though nothing you put into this equation, into this Lagrangian, violates the weak energy condition of general relativity. So there's no actual growth of energy. There's no instabilities. Nevertheless, you would think W is less than minus 1 because you've incorrectly made the assumption that general relativity is correct on large scales in the universe. This is not the way the universe works, but the point is you really have to be careful how you infer microphysical quantities from what you measure in cosmology. And in a sense, I would argue that this is the kind of argument we need, that understanding problems like dark energy and dark matter really requires both, you know, precision, careful particle physics type experiments to work hand in hand with the sort of cosmological experiments that are telling us this stuff is there too, though. It is a scalar tensor theory.
Right. I mean,
like,
what I'm saying is that
with
the
transformer
transformation, and then it's like a regular,
scalar
field coupled
to gravity with time potential. Mm-hmm. So how do you get away from minus? No, if you, this is not quite true. I mean, it's 50% true what you said. So if I do what you said, everything you said will be true in this part of the action, but the conformal transformation you use to map to the Einstein frame will lead to couplings in this sector, and that's what will give you the effect. And in fact, in a while, I'm going to talk about such couple models in some detail. And you'll see this issue arise again. Yeah, right, absolutely. Yep. Yes, you can see this in any frame you like, of course. You have to ask a physical question. It's not frame dependent, and indeed, you'll get that answer. Yep.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, yeah, I think you're saying what I said, yeah. I mean, the point I'm making is that if you measure W less than minus 1, you know, it certainly is in no way obvious that you should start worrying that you have some weird phantom component to the universe. There are other explanations here. But there's a broader point, which is, how do you interpret this data? I mean, what we're trying to do, people like me, and I would suspect half the room at least, is use cosmology. Half of what we do is to use cosmology as a probe of fundamental physics. And this is a place where you have to be really careful in doing that, I think. I don't remember how it works. Okay. Now, of course, once you start thinking this way, there is the question, well, if you can really make gravity mess around with the predictions of regular matter sources, maybe it's all gravity, okay? So all people who have tried modified gravity have a slide like this, which justifies what they're about to do, violate the Einstein-Hilbert action. So there are, precursors to this. So, you know, back when people were worrying about what happened with the behavior of Mercury, people did postulate dark matter. Namely, they postulated Vulcan, this planet. And, of course, we know that the answer was, no, there was a new modification. That's Leverrier. It's a good-looking guy.
Detecting Vulcan.
There were many claims for detecting Vulcan. Yes, more than one, in fact. Right. Of course, this worked the other way with Neptune. Right. Neptune actually worked. But it's not a big mystery why that happens, right? I mean, it's in the regime near the center of the solar system where gravity, you would expect gravity to be stronger, and you might find a change. This is somewhat different to the status we have when we think about modifying gravity for cosmic acceleration, sort of the other regime. But yeah. So anyway, the point here just being that there are pre-existing examples where you've needed to modify gravity to explain a result that was postulated that you needed new matter for. So suppose that you wanted just to modify gravity in order to make the universe accelerate, do away with dark energy. What would you do? Well, you might write down a Lagrangian. That would be handy because we really like general covariance and we don't like to give it up. So you write down a scalar. It's a function of this object G mu nu, the metric, and its derivatives. And then the first thing you might ask is, what are the propagating degrees of freedom in a theory like this? And the answer turns out that, well, there are scalar degrees of freedom and there are tensor degrees of freedom. Now, normally, in general relativity, one doesn't see these. One sees just a graviton. And the reason is not that you included only a graviton field here. The reason is that you included a metric, but you wrote down a theory that has constraints. Okay, the equations of motion are very special. They're constraint equations, and they constrain away these other degrees of freedom, and all you have to propagate is the graviton. If you play around with the Einstein-Hilbert action, you ruin this immediately, except for some very, very special cases, as we'll see in a moment. And so when you think about playing with gravity, you're almost always going to be forced to deal with new degrees of freedom. If you have new degrees of freedom, there are typically two things that come up. There are typically three things that come up. One is a good thing. It allows you to get the universe to accelerate often, which is really handy. But the bad things that can happen are, first, that the new degrees of freedom can change the geodesics in regions that you know general relativity to work very well, namely the solar system. So in the solar system, as I've pointed out already in that Brans-Dickey case, there are great measurements that constrain the geodesics that general relativity has in the solar system, and these can be ruined in some theories. I'll show you an example in a moment where they're catastrophically ruined. Second, they can lead to instabilities, because in general, it was not always true, but it is usually true, the new degrees of freedom that arise from theories like this are ghost-like. They have exactly this wrong sign kinetic term that would give you W less than minus 1 in the case of a scalar. And that can lead, among other things, to a catastrophic decay of the vacuum on microscopic timescales. It's not something you really want in a theory. So let me give you a simple example. These are the so-called F of R theories. And in fact, I'll specialize to an incredibly simple example of the F of R theories that I've shown in other talks. So you modify the Einstein-Hilbert action. So this is based on some work I did with Michael Turner and Sean Carroll and Vikram Davuri several years ago. You modify the Einstein-Hilbert action. You make it a function of the Ricci scalar. And you, just to be very concrete, let's focus on one example where you have 1 over R corrections here. I've written R to the N. I'll really just use 1 over R for almost everything I do here. So why would you do this? Because it's really quite a violent thing to do to the action. Well, one reason you would do it is that this now forbids Minkowski space from being a solution to the equations of motion, which is what you want. At late times, when normal matter dilutes away in an expanding universe, you want the universe to approach something else, an accelerating solution. So this is one way to try to impose that. So the field equation is horrible. It's a complete mess. Nevertheless, you can certainly solve this numerically. You can put in a cosmological ansatz for the metric, and you can put in the usual matter sources for cosmology, where here, by subscript M, I really mean just regular matter, baryons, dark matter, nothing else. Okay. So you can go ahead and solve this equation. One thing you can notice is, I'm not sure if I wrote it on the next slide. I didn't, so let me just go back here and say it. Is that the constant curvature vacuum solutions of this equation is the Sitter space. So it's accelerating, which is nice. Okay. However, it's not stable, and here's why. So I can do a conformal transformation. I can transform to an Einstein frame here, where the whole action is exactly as Turthow has mentioned earlier. It will be the Einstein-Hilbert action with a potential for a scalar that is given precisely by the form of the F of R I chose in the first place, and a universal coupling between the scalar and the graviton. Sorry, and the matter field. So the equations of motion for cosmology in this frame are the normal Friedmann equation, where the energy density of a scalar is given this way, a potential that you can solve for exactly in this case, and then an equation for the scalar that has this extra piece here from this coupling, and the matter energy density goes like, well, I've given matter a general equation state parameter W here, but set that to be 0 for dust, and this is 1 over A cubed that you would be used to, plus a term that depends on the scalar. And now you can see very simply why the de Sitter space solution to this is unstable, because the scalar sitting on the hill here is the de Sitter solution, even in the previous frame, and it's unstable, you can see. Now, what's interesting, however, in this model, or one of the things that's interesting, is that if you look at the late time evolution with the scalar rolling down this potential, it actually also is an accelerating solution. It's a different type of accelerating solution. If you map this solution back into the original frame, which is where I care about it, not because answer to physical questions depends on the frame that I look at, but because in that original frame, matter falls along geodesics of the metric, and that's the only thing I need to describe its evolution, then I have an accelerating universe with the equation of state parameter, which is not of dark energy now. This is the equation of state parameter you would infer being minus 2/3. Not quite consistent with the cosmological data, as I'll mention, but that's easy to fix with the model. This is just an example. But it's accelerating. Mu is a parameter you have to choose, and unsurprisingly, you have to choose that to be of the size of the cosmological constant. It's a new dimension full parameter. Right. I don't need to explain it. I just need to fit the data and make predictions. It's what people used to call science before they thought about string theory. No, I'm just... I don't have an answer, so I will attack. No. I mean, what I'd like to do is have a fundamental theory that gave it to me. That would be great. But I would be actually happier if I could write down a phenomenological model like that and make some new specific prediction that people could go test. That has to be my first choice. Then having a fundamental theory explain it would also be great. Certainly do not have that. Furthermore, I think any attempts I know to try to extract it from fundamental theories have not been successful. So people have tried, and I don't think they've been successful. So, yeah. Oh, so again, mu has to be of order what you'd normally think of as a cosmological constant today. So, no, it's the other extreme. That's right. So it's a very abnormally low scale that you have to choose. That's right. Yeah, I'll show you actually. If I don't answer your question in two slides, bug me again. Stefan. There's a de Sitter solution in both frames. That de Sitter solution is unstable in both frames. So if I put the de Sitter solution in the original frame, it will become unstable. The equations of motion are horrible, but it becomes unstable, and it's unstable to this accelerating solution.
Yeah, I guess the thing that I'm missing is W, normally I associate pure
cosmological
W is minus, exactly minus 1.
And it is. So when you normally think of a de Sitter solution of Einstein gravity with a cosmological constant, that solution is stable. So it will sit there. If you do, in this theory, there is a de Sitter solution, and that solution is unstable. This is no more mysterious, should be no more mysterious to you than if I gave you a scalar field coupled to Einstein gravity and just made that scalar field have an unstable point. That's all that's going on here, okay? I mean, I think what I said is precisely correct, but I think you guys might be trying to expect more from it. It is a de Sitter solution. If you sit it there, it will classically sit there forever, and that will be the solution, period. But it is unstable. If you perturb it, it will go away from that. You can sit it right on that hump, right, and it'll be there forever. Yeah, it's exact solution.
The next
consequence you showed, so what I showed was that what it is in the original frame, you can do the numerics. You actually will find this solution. But in this frame, you can just see what happens. This thing rolls down here, and actually you can see the asymptotic behavior. And for those of you that are used to looking at exponential potentials and inflation, you'll recognize it, because for large phi, this becomes just an exponential potential. And it has an exact solution, which is a power law. And that's why this behaves this way at late times. Yeah? Say that again. I have no idea. This particular model is going to fail so poorly, so badly in the solar system that will not be my primary worry. But maybe someone else has an answer to that. I don't know. It's a good question. There are a class of these models that you can fix up in the solar system. So that would be an interesting question to ask about them, and I don't know the answer. I don't know if Roy would have an answer later on. Okay, so as I said, as I almost said, you can map this theory to a Brans-Dickey theory as well, and the reason I might just want to do that is just to show you that this is like a Brans-Dickey theory with this omega parameter 0. You'll recall I told you it needs to be bigger than 40,000, and this is one way to see that it fails horribly in the solar system. Okay. Nevertheless, that's okay. I mean, I just want to show you this example because I can solve it all exactly, and I want to just show you the large-scale acceleration. To make this work in the solar system is rather complicated. If you want to face the cosmological data with this model, as Abhay was asking, you could, just within this simple model, just include generally 1 over n here. You can still solve it exactly. The late-time solution goes like t to the q. You can extract an exact equation of state parameter. And in fact, the bigger your n, the closer to minus 1 you get, as you might expect. So that's what happens in those. Does that answer your question, Abhay?
So what happens to the potential?
I can show you later. I can't do it off the top of my head, but... It does. Yeah, I think that's probably right. I mean, but the point is, I can actually, this is can be done analytically. I can just write it down for you. It's in our paper, I think. I just don't have it in front of me. It's the one thing I didn't put on the slide, actually. Okay, so you can make fit the cosmological data here. One shouldn't make too big a deal out of this. So it's just interesting that you can modify gravity and get this acceleration and fit this expansion history. Okay. Now, one way you would like to look at these models... to distinguish them from, say, a cosmological constant or something else, is you'd like to say, okay, I can fit the expansion history. So what else would I measure? And one thing you can measure is structure formation. And in the FFR theories, here are a couple of examples. Here's the one I just talked about. Here's a sort of more complicated one that looks a lot like a cosmological constant at late times. And the only point I want to take away from these graphs is that, so what you're seeing here is the matter power spectrum. You've got lambda CDM, which is in the full black line, cis fitted to the Sloan data. And no matter how you normalize, so there's red dashed lines and red dot dashed here, which are normalized in different ways. But the point is, if you fit to the large scale data, you miss the small scale data. And if you fit to the small scale data, you miss the large scale data. So you cannot simultaneously fit the microwave background and large scale structure in a wide class of these models. Yes? In the Einstein frame, the only place is the coupling. Yes. Yes. Yep, that's right. I'll have more to say about the details of how you do this kind of thing in couple models in a while, but this will be a special case. It's not clear that it means it's mildly coupled to matter. There are two ways to get around the solar system test. One is to choose a form for F of R that has several scales in it that allows you to evade the solar system test while still getting appreciable, interesting behavior on cosmic scales. Okay, those look like horrible functions. I'll be honest, I haven't studied those functions in any great detail. They're not very pretty. The other way is to use a chameleon-like effect. That's right. So then it matters of the local matter density, and I think Roy is going to talk about that briefly. Yeah. What's your... Well, once I've normalized to large scale... I guess I'm not quite sure what you're... Yes, right. So I would have thought, yes, that's a good question. I would have thought that the fact that I'm reproducing an exact expansion history means that the redshift space distortion would be the same. So the point here is, I'm not sure about the second part of what you said, but the point here is that sort of fixing the expansion history to be exactly, essentially, what you would expect from lambda CDM, or close enough, and then just studying what happens to this overall. Yes. Yes. Yeah, that I don't know. Yeah. I don't know what to say about what I say. Yeah. But there's a tilt here. There's a tilt here going on. Right. I don't care about where I'm not complaining that I cannot fit large scales or cannot fit small scales. I'm complaining that if I allow myself the freedom to choose to fit one, I can't do the other. Right. Yeah. Well, that might be a good thing to discuss tomorrow. I don't think I know enough about that to answer that question properly. Yeah, you would have to mess up a lot to make the difference, right? But maybe you can. Yeah. I think the bias thing, I don't know the answer to that. Redshift distortion, I think, is clear because I've been careful to reproduce the background expansion the same way. Okay, so anyway, now this class that I just wrote down was a class of coupled models. It was mapped to a class of coupled models. It sort of begs the question, you know, more broadly, suppose that you have something that's causing the acceleration of the universe. Maybe it's part of the gravitational sector. Maybe it's a quintessence field on its own. If you write down coupled models, what kinds of constraints can you put on those? And this is a long subject with many, many people who have worked on it in different ways, in the chameleon fields and the mass-varying neutrinos and the mavens. And there are many of these things, and I won't talk about all of these things at all here. I'll just give you one example of the kind of constraint that can arise in theories like this. So let's model a dot coupling in the following way. We'll write down a general Lagrangian for a scalar field which is going to be causing the universe to accelerate, coupled to having a potential, and coupled to a set of matter fields with different couplings like this. If you like, a way to think about this is that the jth components of the matter distribution falls along geodesics that are governed by a metric gj, which is given by this. Okay, so this is going to be quite tightly constrained, and I certainly won't do, a full analysis of this here. Instead, I will focus for the rest of the talk on one coupling between dark matter and dark energy. So I'll only consider dark matter here, and the coupling I'll call alpha of phi. Okay, so this is... Well, I'm going to actually show where one instability develops. Not the kind of instability I talked about before, but a different instability develops here. Right. Yes, I don't want this to be able to be mapped to a ghost-like model. That would be catastrophic. Yes. That's right. That's actually rather simple to do. Yeah. So we'll model matter as a perfect fluid. And what are the equations of motion? So the Einstein tensor is now equated to the energy-momentum tensor for the scalar field plus the energy-momentum tensor for matter, which is now coupled in this non-trivial way to the scalar, and the equation of motion for phi in a very similar way to happened for the F of R model picks up this extra dependence here on the scalar field, phi. These are just background equations, of course. Now, again, there are many things you can ask in these models, but there's one particular regime which is sort of interesting, which I'll call the adiabatic regime. This is the regime, and this will be, this, whether you're in this regime or not, will depend on the environment you're in, whether you're in the cosmological densities or close in with a lot of density, for example, in a galaxy. This will be a different question on different scales. But the adiabatic regime is when the dark energy field adiabatically tracks the minimum of its effective potential. So I'll go back to this equation that I had here, and I will rewrite this equation as an effective potential for phi, with two different contributions. One is that background potential I put in, and one is the sort of environmentally dependent part, which depends on the field, the energy density rho. So the adiabatic regime will be when the field adiabatically tracks that minimum. It just is always in the minimum of this potential and tracks it at every moment of time. Okay? So the background solution for phi in a case like this is fixed, and it's fixed as a function of rho, because it's a solution to this equation at all times. This is what it means to adiabatically track the minimum, that the field is always at the minimum of that potential. So I can rewrite phi as phi minimum, and it's a function of rho. It's a solution. Rho is the, so I haven't, it depends what the environment is I'm talking about right now. So rho is the energy density of the matter that I put into Lagrangian, the dark matter. But the questions I'm going to ask, will, the answers to them will depend on whether I'm talking about cosmological scales, galactic scales, cluster scales. It'll change. It'll very much depend on the environment, as you'll see. So the effective equations of motion for are now, the P effective of rho for the scalar is minus V of rho, because there's no kinetic motion anymore at the scalar. It's in the adiabatic regime. And I can rewrite the Einstein equation in this somewhat complicated way, which simplifies to this. M Planck squared, the Einstein tensor is this. Okay, where phi M is the minimum which is given by the solution of this equation. Okay? So this is a very simple system. Now, what happens to the equation of state in a model like this? Well, first thing that happens is the following. So you write down the observed equation of state parameter as a function of A. It's given by this. And this is a very important point that I made earlier, which is in general about how you interpret the things you write down. If you look at the observed value and you plug in what I told you from the previous slide, it looks like this. And you can immediately say two things about all models that are like this. One, W will always be less than minus one today in a model like this. And all I've done is couple the dark matter and dark energy in a certain way. So you will always measure W less than minus one today in a model like this. And furthermore, if you just expand this out, as you might expect, in the recent past you will also measure W less than minus one. It doesn't have to be significantly less, but it will be less just because of the structure of this equation. Okay? So again, you will infer W less than minus one. It doesn't mean there's a matter component in there which is violating the energy conditions of GR. It means that there's a coupling in this case to them. Yeah, that's what's going on here. This depends on I'm writing this in a very specific way here. It depends on the potential and on the coupling, and I've chosen to write it all in terms of only the potential and the coupling.
Right, yeah? But
I don't think so. I mean, it's an exponential coupling. I'm requiring that there exist an adiabatic regime. Yes. Hold on. I mean, there's two things. Not just that minimum exists, but that the field always be in it.
Right.
I have explicitly gotten rid of the kinetics of the scalar field, phi. So if you don't do that, you'll get a different answer. But if you're in the adiabatic regime, this is the answer.
Yeah. No matter what the potential is.
No matter what the potential is, as long as there exists an adiabatic minimum. So my claim here depends on two statements, one that this be positive and one that this be positive. And d log v by d alpha being positive is the statement that there exists an adiabatic minimum in this potential. Yep. Yep. Mm-hmm. Yes. I think almost certainly does. Right. Yes. Yep. So I haven't thought of it that way, but that would make sense to me. Because if you look back at the continuity equation, it has that extra term that looks like alpha prime. That's what's coming in here. So I think, it has to have a sign. Right. Exactly. But so it might be equivalent to that. Yeah. Sure. We can talk about that. Okay. So when is the adiabatic regime valid? Well, it's valid when you can write down a condition, the local adiabatic condition, in the following way. So consider some perturbation, all right, that is on the length scale or time scale, I don't care, L, and on density rho. Then the rough necessary condition for the local adiabatic condition to hold is that the length scale will be much bigger than the inverse mass of the scalar field. Okay? This is sort of a very, this should make sense. This is the condition that you not be able to jiggle that scalar field around over the size of this perturbation. So it will stay in its minimum. You'll be in the adiabatic regime. Okay? And it corresponds to this condition. So this is sort of a rough condition. You have to be a little careful here because you're in a curved background. So you have to be a little careful. But in fact, it turns out that precisely what happens here is that if d log v by d log rho times this quantity is much less than 1, then you have this local adiabatic condition and you're in the adiabatic minimum. Okay, so this is the same as this condition except for this little modification here. And if this holds everywhere, the adiabatic approximation holds. And if this doesn't hold everywhere, there are some ways in which it can fail non-locally, but I won't worry about that here. I'll just assume that I have this. This will be the requirement I make of my theory. Okay? So this is the condition that the adiabatic condition holds. It doesn't have to hold. And as you can see, it depends on how big your perturbation is and the energy density. So again, it's an environmentally dependent condition. Now, suppose that you're in an adiabatic minimum like this. What happens? So there are several ways to look at what happens. I'm going to show you that there's an instability, typically, and show you a couple of ways to look at it. Okay? One way is the hydrodynamic way. Okay? So this is the equation I showed you earlier, that the effective energy density in the dark matter is given by this equation, which I've chosen to write in terms of the potential and dV by d alpha, where alpha is this coupling. And if you do that, then the adiabatic sound speed, defined this way, can be just rewritten in terms of these quantities as this. Now, in the adiabatic regime, the sound of speed, that thing with an S on the bottom, is equal to the adiabatic that thing, and therefore the question of the stability comes down to what is the sine of the adiabatic sound speed squared. I'm glad I didn't have that drink with lunch. So, instability occurs if this is less than zero. Okay? And this now puts you into a direct constraint on dV by d alpha and its derivatives. So, what I'm interested in is when there exists the following situation. I'm in the adiabatic regime, so there exists a range in which I'm in the adiabatic regime, and it's unstable, because I'd like to constrain these models. So there are two regions of parameter space where this is true. If I have dV by d alpha, remember alpha is the coupling between dark matter and dark energy. If dV by d alpha is less than d squared V by d alpha squared is less than zero, they're both negative, or I have this relationship between them, then it turns out that I'm both in the adiabatic regime and adiabatically unstable. Okay? The instability operates over a range of scales in this case. The range of scales has to be long enough, and it must grow on a time scale that is less than the Hubble time scale. Okay? Otherwise, we don't care. If there's something in the universe that is unstable on the Hubble time scale or greater, so what? It's not really unstable. The entire universe is unstable on the Hubble time scale. It's evolving. Okay? And so this is that condition, that you have sort of an interesting range of scales over which it's happening that you can actually claim that you'll get predictions that differ with those of the standard cosmology. I'll show you an example in a moment of that. Generally, for a fluid, the instability timescale has to be shorter than the gravitational dynamical timescale, is what I'm saying here, for this to make sense. And you can put all that together to show that the maximum range length scale on which the adiabatic instability holds and you're unstable, divided by the minimum length scale, can be bounded in this way, and therefore this is non-empty only if alpha prime is much bigger than 1. So in other words, this is an instability that comes into play only when the coupling between dark matter and dark energy is significantly stronger than gravitational. Okay? So that's where it holds. So certainly minimally coupled fields will not satisfy this. Okay? So the point here is, again, you want to be in the adiabatic regime, you want to be unstable, and you don't want to be, but I'm interested in the regions where we are, and this instability has to act on timescales or length scales that are short compared to the gravitational timescale. Now, there's another way to see this, which is sort of in the gravitational sense. So if you look in the Einstein frame, then the instability is nothing to do with gravity. It's all about the scalar and the coupling. That's what I just showed you. But in the Jordan frame, where I sort of let matter fall along geodesics of the right metric, then the instability involves gravity. And in fact, the way it happens is that if you work in the Jordan frame, and I'm not going to calculate this here, I just want to give you a flavor of what happens, the effective Newton's constant, as Katie was mentioning earlier, in some models, changes. And the Newton's constant for the self-interaction of dark matter now has a couple of different terms. One is the tensor piece that you know and love, and one comes from the scalar part of this interaction. So in the Jordan frame, this is partly a gravitational effect. And at long scales, this coupling just reverts to the normal Newton's constant. And at short ones, it can be approximated this way. Okay? So because of that, what happens? So again, if you're in this regime, this condition that I told you about, I think I've switched my units here. It doesn't matter. Again, that the coupling strength be significantly stronger than gravity. Then there's a range of length scales. This corresponds to what I wrote on the previous slide, where GCC can be approximated this way. And if you look at the equation for the growth of perturbations, it looks like this. And the point here is that usually what happens is Hubble damping turns the exponential instability that you have into a power law instability. And this is how structure grows in the universe. And what will happen in this range of length scales is that this new coupling will turn you again into an exponential growth. So the Hubble damping that normally ameliorates the exponential growth of perturbations in a flat universe doesn't work properly anymore, or is superseded by this effect of the coupling. So this is a resurgence of the genes instability that happens in these models. So let me just give you an example of what happens. I'm going to skip this slide. I'm just going to show you one simple example. We wrote down a two-component dark matter model that we could show was consistent with every other measurement that you could make. We produced the right expansion history, et cetera, et cetera. And let me sort of skip through this because it's not particularly interesting, unless you're twisted enough to like looking at these equations. Some of you are, actually, I know that, but let's forget this. But let me just move on. The point is, it's a two-component model. I can write down the perturbation equations, but what you really care about is what happens to the perturbations. So let me just show you. And I don't want to show it on this. This is too complicated. Let me go to the next slide. Here we go. So this is growth of perturbations. This is what happens in lambda C to M, this growth. And what's happening here is there are two. This is the fractional overdensity for the coupled component, which is in red. We have in this also a non-coupled component to dark matter. So we're trying to give dark matter the biggest chance here. We allow part of it not to be coupled, not only a little bit of it to be coupled. But in fact, what happens is that they both grow uncontrollably at late times. This adiabatic behavior triggers this growth, and this leads to predictions that are completely inconsistent with observations. It's just what I showed you. It's this instability that causes the perturbations in the coupled fluid system to grow because, if you like, in the Jordan frame, which is where I sort of think about this, there's a genes instability that wasn't there previously. So these theories in this regime are ruled out because of this instability. Absolutely. The point here is just to show that there are a variety of different ways of getting your constraints on these models and narrowing down the allowed places, the allowed types of couplings that can happen, that you can then go to ask questions about, well, where do they fit into fundamental theory and questions like that. So this is what I just said. So let me summarize. For some reason it says summary two. Why? Presumably I erased summary one somewhere along the way. So it might be that there are new energy components that are driving cosmic acceleration. It might be that there's quintessence or a cosmological constant or something like that. Or maybe the response of space-time to the things we know about, dark matter, baryons, is just different. Maybe we don't understand gravity in the far infrared. That's a possibility. This is very constrained, as I've tried to show you, and I think Roy will say considerably more about. And so it really is quite challenging to come up with sensible models of modified gravity that give you cosmic acceleration and make sense. In general, no matter what you do here, you might expect there to be couplings between these different areas. It's somewhat unnatural in the context of writing down a sort of fundamental theory of everything to write down completely disparate sectors for different parts of the universe. You would expect them to be coupled. And when you introduce couplings, a lot of different kinds of instabilities can appear. And so, as I say here, in lots of particle physics motivated proposals, there'll be non-trivial couplings between the different sectors. And there, in some cosmological environments, some ranges of couplings, there are huge instabilities that rule out large classes of the models. Okay. the thing I showed you here, just to be specific for the workshop, and we can talk about other examples at length in the discussion session, hopefully tomorrow, I just talked about here this thing I call the idiopathic instability. Thanks. Do the chameleon models in some range of parameter space? Yes. Right, just in some range of parameter space. Right. Yeah. We talk about that partly in the paper.
Sorry.
We talk about that partly in the paper. Yeah. The F of all models do not. They are never in the adiabatic regime. Yeah. I don't know. So let me say two things. First of all, my comment was absolutely not meant to say that, you know, a cosmological constant is an ugly theoretical thing. I mean, it would be very interesting from the point of view of fundamental theory what it makes a small cosmological constant. So I think we're on the same wavelength there. But I don't know of a single measurement that or any combination of measurements that you could ever do to convince everyone completely that there is a cosmological constant. Right. So the point one should try to do, in my opinion, is to map out the space of possible things that can cause it and look for the predictions they make and rule them out one by one. The thing about... So just in case I wasn't clear, because I'm sort of afraid I wasn't, my comment was not supposed to be disparaging of the idea of a cosmological constant. The point was that I can make all kinds of predictions from other models that I can then use to kill them, which is nice. It is very hard to see what I can do to kill a cosmological constant. It doesn't mean it's not interesting theoretically, but it just means it's challenging. And so it's one point in the parameter space of possible models. And we might end up with it, but it's sort of incumbent on us to map out what the possible space of models is and then narrow that down by doing science with it. I think that's what the spirit in which all these approaches are taken in, modified gravity, quintessence, coupled models, is to map out what can be possible and then try to, you know, winnow them down to some set. Lambda will always be there. That's the thing. I agree with that.
Is there a way to, if there are the same way we think of effective theories, and you say we have a sector, has anyone showed, that, for example, just like in Sakharov's whole idea that you can induce, some fixed gravity?
I didn't understand that. What do you mean, some fixed gravity?
Induced gravity,
okay.
You can actually induce, in the presence of matter field,
mm-hmm.
the one, the F of R, or, terms that...
No, no one has ever shown that. No, no.
That would be really
interesting. It would be cool, I agree. Stefan wanted to know if anyone had tried to use an induced gravity model. So basically, take gravity in the presence of matter fields, and in some sense, use the interaction of gravity with the matter fields to induce higher other terms in the action for gravity. But no, they haven't to get that. I don't even know how that would work.
All these models of gravity, do any of them also solve the horizon problem?
Well, so this is a very different regime I'm talking about. I mean, the very first model of inflation that was written down was by Starobinsky. Starobinsky's model of inflation actually is of the type that I wrote down. Starobinsky's model has, the Einstein-Hilbert action plus some R squared term. And this is an F of R model on its own and can, in fact, give you cosmic acceleration in the way that I described. It's at a very different scale. So, of course, when we started talking about these F of R models, the very first thing a bunch of people did was say, look, I could write a really crazy function that gives you both these things. So you can do that. I guess the only comment I have about that is I'm not sure anything has been gained that was not gained by doing the two things separately right now. So I don't know how to constrain the system more by doing it together. But you can certainly get it that way, yeah. And then so these, in turn, solve the horizon problem if you're happy that the fact that inflation solved the Harris problem. Yes, yes. Some phi r squared term. Yeah. Sorry, phi r term. Squared r. Yep. Yeah, this is the statement that if you set minimal coupling, you will naturally move away from it, move away from it. But so I'm aware of that, but I guess that's a little different. That's sort of like a Brands-Dickey type theory that one ends up with. Yeah. Well, it's the matter sector that differs. But, yeah.
So, there are a couple of questions. First is that, as you nicely explained just now, that maybe ultimately just for point of constant, but more than experiment data uses a window, so you can say that's exactly
right.
So, and so we explore various possibilities. But there's another thing, which is flatness. Experiment data, of course, never tells us that.
Right.
But in that case, there's much less interest in the community.
Well, that's because we think we have an idea. We know why, and we don't. First of all, I mean, we don't. So let me just shamelessly repeat the lore of the community, and so we don't think that k is zero. Right? We think we don't care what k is, because we think the scale factor got so big that it made it irrelevant. No, sorry. All I'm saying is that I'm not saying I would be philosophically worried if k were not zero. I'm saying that we think we have a mechanism that makes measurement of spatial curvature that you'll never measure spatial curvature, and that's inflation. Right. So we think we have a mechanism for that. So. For example, if we thought we had a mechanism that would give us a very, very small cosmological constant, no matter where you started off, that would sort of renormalize to zero or scale it away to something very small, I think we might not worry about it either.
But in both cases, that's not the same. Even in the second case, that's not the same. That it has to be
the same. It's omega k, I guess I'm talking about. Right, so in inflation, as you well know, I mean, you know, there's the term in the Friedman equation that is k over a squared. So if a increases exponentially, if I rewrite the Friedman equation so that this term can be re-encoded as omega k, this becomes so close to zero that I never re-emerges in the history of the universe so far. So we don't set k to be zero in inflation, right? You actually rewrite the Friedman equation. Sorry about your priors. So you rewrite the Friedman equation in the following way. D omega by dA is up to a sign, 1 plus 3w omega minus 1 over a squared. And now, let's see if I get my signs right. So if you've just got regular matter in the universe and this thing is positive, then the fixed points of this are 0, 1, 1, and wherever you start, you get driven to 0 very, very quickly. Whereas if you have an inflationary period, you still have a k, but you get driven so close to omega as 1 that never in the history of the universe later do you depart from it sufficiently. So we don't set it to 0 by hand. Right, so if I could write lambda today is lambda Planckian times, divided by A to some power, and A got really big, I'd be delighted with an answer like that. But we don't have something like that, I guess, is why I'm making a distinction between the two. I'm not hung up on the functional form, yeah.
Many of these theories
this is Wayne Hu and collaborators, or?
No, Wall and
Oh. Yes, okay.
Basically, they just set it up, what it puts stars, and just the stability of the ABC, and of course, we know that nearly the dawning stars are very stable from the first stars. Like, for one thing, is, I think, for a very bright cluster, for example, they're all stable, so stars should not be around us.
Yep. Yeah, so I think, as I was sort of finished with saying here, like I chose to focus on one thing here. So there are other instabilities that happen, for sure. And this particular one, actually, Ron, I was talking about, I have that and another paper that I need to read sitting on my desk. But I'm aware of the conclusions of that paper, and it is what you said. So there are, and there are other papers as well. But, I mean, the instability that I described here has been spoken about in more limited context by other people and different couple models. So there are a whole range of instabilities, I agree. So I can't tell you about the stability of star answer because I don't know that. I don't know. Are you going to mention that in your talk? Or? Okay. I mean, I think the point is that so for the there are several different constraints. So one thing that happens is in cosmological evolution, if you want to get the right background evolution, you have to avoid something called the phi cold dark matter dominated era. So you try to get radiation domination in the far past, and you miss it, and you get something else. So to avoid that, you need some F double prime back then to be negative. So there's a whole bunch of constraints on the function. Then there's a constraint that you not be in some situation like I spoke about here, but in fact it turns out the F of R theory is never in that. The condition that you be stable at late times forces you to be very close to a cosmological constant at late times. You always have to be at late times. That's, you know, not a boring answer because the structure formation is what matters for distinguishing between the... Yes, that's what I mean. Late times is now. But the question of the particular thing you're talking about, the stellar instability constraints, I don't know. So these things end up looking... The classes that I know that still seem to work end up very close to a cosmological constant today. They have some weird coupling to matter that allows them to behave themselves in the solar system. And then there are other constraints that you mentioned that I don't know of. So I would say that particular class of models, the F of R ones, are becoming very contrived. I mean, not becoming, have been quite contrived for quite some while. It's unlikely that they're going to survive very long. The F of R models, yeah. But they've been sort of one of our best candidates for the modifications of gravity. They're based on an action. They're not just a change of the equation of motion. They're an actual action you can write down. And so, but they're actually extremely constrained. I agree. Yep.
I remember we had one problem, which is, so you have one component of dark matter,
yep.
And then another part of the coupling.
Yep.
Which are limited to giving like a quote, in the sense that it's like a that coupled with dark energy. So the coupled dark matter plus dark energy has the same equation of state, right? And they are related to
the same equation of state. What question? What do you, same as what?
So you have, say, rho times e to the power mu phi and some other e of phi. These two together, the energy density of these two together is behaving like, you know, giving rise to the
pressure. Yes, it's true. Ratio of energy densities?
Yes.
Okay.
Density,
yeah.
Of and
yep.
That would actually change a little bit from...
Yes. The yeah, that's almost... Well, of course it depends. You could also couple to baryons, but... You'll be strongly... Yeah, that's... Yeah, okay, fine. I think I agree with everything you said, yeah.
So in that case, there are some constraints. So you have a scheme between
Right.
And recombination.
Mm-hmm.
But then there are all these other, like, local, you know, from galaxy, light
mm-hmm.
to mass ratio.
Right. No, I haven't. That's interesting. I'd like to hear more about that. Yeah. Sounds like an interesting way to think about this.
Since we finished the first part of the session earlier, perhaps we could meet.